Please join me in 2 Chronicles chapter 27. We were last talking about the death of King Uzziah after 52 years on the throne, and the vision that Isaiah the prophet saw of the true king of the Israeli people. He who is always enthroned in the heavenly realm. When Uzziah died, the next man to become the solo king of southern Judah was his son Jotham. Now, Jotham has already been functioning as the king of southern Judah for about 3 years because his dad contracted leprosy for doing a very foolish thing of trying to burn incense in the temple at the beginning of his 50th year on the throne. And even before Uzziah contracted leprosy, he had already designated Jotham as his crown prince, kind of almost a co-king. And so Jotham has been at this for a few years now, when he becomes the solo king. So in 2 Chronicles chapter 27, let's remind ourselves of who Jotham is. Jotham was 25 years old when he began to reign. I actually think that age is when he was first designated by his father as the co-king or as the crown prince. And he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem. And I also believe that timing comes from his earlier designation. His mother's name was Jerusha, the daughter of Zadok. He did what was right in the eyes of He Who Is, according to all that his father Uzziah had done, except he did not enter the temple of He Who Is. So, little reminder that Uzziah was a very good king. I plan on meeting him one of these days when we're in glory, tracking him down and letting him tell me his story. I'm sure there'll be a whole bunch of us wanting to hear that from his lips. But his son Jotham, who will also, I think, be in glory with us, he was also a good king. He didn't make the foolish mistake that his father did. He did not try to go into the temple and act like a priest. So that's good. However, we're told this, but the people still followed corrupt practices. So there are problems, even though we've had the long reign of good King Uzziah, and now we're in the reign of his son, good King Jotham. There's still some people that are worshiping gods and goddesses on the sly. Maybe some of them are doing them in their own private rooms, private homes. Maybe they're doing it out at a little private, covert worship site. But that's still going on. Now, verse 3 tells us some of the things that he was involved in. Verse 3 says, he built the upper gate of the house of He Who Is. Now, this upper gate, or this high gate, seems to me to be the gate at the top of the stairs that was on the south side of the temple complex. And so what the design was with King Solomon is that he built the temple at the top of the Temple Mount, and then he built his royal complex of his palace and the throne room complex and the meeting complex called the house or the palace of the Forest of Lebanon. And then he also had his chariot and horse complex. And so those are on both sides of this stairway that goes from the ancient city of Jerusalem down in the south, the city of David, where the old palace used to be. And so the ascending stairs terminated at the south entrance to the worship area of the temple. And that's where the high or upper gate was located. Now, it had already been built back in the time of Solomon. So what we're being told here is that he is renovating it. He is refreshing it because it's been a while. After all, it's over two centuries since the temple was built. And so no doubt a lot of the architecture needed to be firmed back up again. And then the second half of verse 3 says, and he did much building on the wall of the Ophel. Now the Ophel is the area that kind of what I was just talking about here, between the temple complex and the north wall of the ancient city of Jerusalem, that little oval that used to be Jebus and then became Jerusalem and then became the city of David. So when Solomon built the temple complex, he walled in all that area between the new buildings and the old city. And over there on the southeast side of this new palace area, that would be the Ophel Wall. It went along the Kidron Valley up to connect with the temple walls. So apparently that region was also in need of some refurbishment. Verse number 4, it's not the only thing he did. Moreover, he built cities in the hill country of Judah and forts and towers in the wooded hills. So he's looking around at the situation that his kingdom is in, and he figures, well, we need some more cities. We need some more fortified positions. We need some more positions to keep an eye on anyone that tries to invade our country and where we can kind of stand against them. Then verse 5, he fought with the king of the Ammonites and prevailed against them. Now, weirdly enough, the Ammonites do not share a border with the kingdom of Judah. The Ammonites are actually on the east side of eastern northern Israel. And so there's a whole other country between Judah and the Ammonites. But apparently the Ammonites looked at this new king, Jotham, and thought maybe they could cause trouble for him. And he fights back and he beats them. And of course, once he beat them, he can demand tribute from them. And so the Ammonites gave him that year 100 talents of silver. So they didn't use coins at this time, so just weighted amounts of silver. Each talent's about 75 pounds or so. So we're talking about over $1 million worth of modern-day buying power. And 10,000 cores of wheat. Each core here is about 6 bushels, or think of like 110 2-liter bottles full. So that's an awful lot of wheat, and then the same amount of barley. That's in a single year of tribute required from the Ammonites because of war reparations. The Ammonites paid him the same amount in the second and third years. So for 3 years, he required the Ammonites to pay back for the trouble they caused in this attack upon Judah. Verse 6 then says, "So Jotham became mighty because he ordered his ways before he who is his God." So God is helping him because he is a good man. But something happens that is not explicitly declared in the inspired writings here, but which we can kind of deduce from some of the chronological information. And that is, around the year 734, Jotham's son Ahaz came of age, meaning he reached his majority age of 20. He had already been declared the crown prince of Judah by Jotham at an earlier age when he was about 16, I think. And so now he has got it in his head that he can do things better than his dad, who's right around 40. And my guess is, and again, this is speculation going on here, but I think it's reasonable. You remember that to the north of Judah, they have the kingdom of Israel, which from time to time causes trouble for the Judean people. And then north of northern Israel, there is the kingdom of Syria, headquartered out of Damascus. And the Syrians from time to time have caused trouble for the Judean people and for the Israeli people as well. And then north of Syria is the Assyrian Empire. Tiglath-Pileser III is the king of that region. And he has been in an expansive rebuilding of the Assyrian Empire. He's already taken over all of the old places, plus a little bit new, to the north of his core region. And so he's taken over pretty much all of Mesopotamia by now. And so the Judeans are well aware that there's a lot of unease among the different regions north of them, that the Israelis and the Syrians are kind of partnering together because they're worried about the Assyrians because they've already had trouble from the Assyrians. And the Syrians and the Israelis wouldn't mind having Judah's resources in fighting against the expanding Neo-Assyrian Empire. My guess is that King Jotham is wanting to stand firm and trust God to protect the kingdom of Judah from all of these problems. But Ahaz, his son, now 20 years of age and the crown prince, is worried about Judah being invaded by the Israelis and the Syrians. And he figures, it's time for me to take control from my dad, because he's not taking care of things here. And so it would appear that God allows Ahaz to usurp his father. He doesn't kill his father. I don't know if he puts him in jail or if he just has him watched, but somehow We know that Jotham lives on for at least four more years after this. But his kingdom, Jotham's kingdom, comes to an end at this point in 734 BC, and Ahaz becomes the new king of southern Judah. We can go to chapter 16 of 2 Kings and start reading about this new king. It says, in the 17th year of Pekah, the son of Remaliah, Ahaz, the son of Jotham, king of Judah, began to reign. Ahaz was 20 years old when he began to reign, and then he reigned for 16 years in Jerusalem. That's a total amount of time that he serves in any type of leadership capacity. But then we have the description of him. He did not do what was right in the eyes of he who is his God, as his father David had done, but he walked in the way of the kings of Israel. Now, it doesn't mean that he is worshiping the golden calves necessarily, like the kings of northern Israel did, but rather that he's got the same type of paganism in his heart. And this is a problem. At this point, I want to flip over to the 2 Chronicles 28 passage because it describes some more detail about some of the things that he does. Chapter 28 of 2 Chronicles says some things in the first two verses that we've already read, but then it says this in the second half of verse 2. He even made metal images for the Baals. So he brings Baal worship back to the forefront in southern Judah. It had been there when Athaliah was the usurper queen, but then it was done away with once she was gone. But now it's back again because this guy is more in mind with paganism than he is with the worship of the one true God. Then verse 3, listen to this. And he made offerings in the valley of the son of Hinnom. That's the valley that goes on the south side of the most ancient portion of the city of Jerusalem. It eventually becomes the name from which we get the Greek term for hell. It's Gehinnom, Gehenna. And so the Valley of the Sons of Hinnom, he starts putting up sacrifice altars down there, and he burned his sons as an offering according to the abominations of the nations whom he who is drove out before the people of Israel. So that means that he adopted for himself the worship of Molech and Chemosh of the Ammonites and the Moabites, and that same worship had been adopted by other Canaanite groups. And the way that this was carried out was that I believe possibly once a year to begin with, probably on the anniversary of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, you would get together with others wanting to worship this god of destruction, this king of destruction. And there'd be a lot of music, there'd be a lot of drinking, and everybody, once they got drunk, would have sexual activity with the intention of causing pregnancies. And then they would bring the babies from the last time this happened. And if it was an annual affair, these babies would be about 3 months old. And then they would burn these babies up as sacrifices to Chemosh Molech, the king of destruction. And this was a vile form of human sacrifice. These babies only existed to be sacrifices. And so here we have Ahaz intentionally bringing that worship back to the forefront in southern Judah, and he participates in it. He impregnates a woman and then burns that baby up as part of the sacrifice. I am so sorry to have to gross you out with that, but you need to understand how bad things are turning now. And remember, this is just a matter of years from good King Uzziah's long reign. And it's just a couple of years after good King Jotham has been doing the right thing. But his son takes over and does all this horrible stuff. And we're still not done. It says that he sacrificed and made offerings on the high places and on the hills and under every green tree. So he has focused his attention, and therefore the attention of many of his subjects, on pagan practices, Canaanite-like practices, abominable type practices, rather than on the worship of the true and living God. And that is why God allows Judah to be invaded. Continue in verse 5 of 2 Chronicles 28. Therefore, he who is his God gave him into the hand of the king of Syria. And it's not just the king of Syria, it's also the king of northern Israel. Once Jotham seizes power, that seems to signal to these two allies north of him, perfect time to move in and take him over. So this king of Syria defeated Ahaz and took captive a great number of his people and brought them to Damascus. He was also given into the hand of the king of Israel, who struck him with great force. For Pekah, remember, he's the king of northern Israel, the son of Remaliah, killed 120,000 from Judah in one day, all of them men of valor, because they had forsaken he who is the God of their fathers. So we've seen this before, that when the covenant is broken, when the covenant is abandoned, God quits blessing and allows the curses to fall and allows them to be invaded. He takes down the wall of protection. And so under bad King Ahaz, God opens the northern border, and Syria and northern Israel flood in, and they kill a whole bunch of Israelis, and they capture a whole bunch of Israelis. Verse number 7, Zichri, a mighty man of Ephraim, killed Maaseiah, the king's son, who must have been like a little bitty kid. Because remember, King Ahaz only comes to power when he's 20. And he killed Azikram, the commander of the palace, and Elkanah, the next in authority to the king. So the northern Israelis are able to push so far deep into Judah that they're able to assassinate one of the sons of the king of southern Judah and several of his leading personnel. Verse number 8, the men of Israel took captive 200,000 of their relatives, meaning the southern Judeans, women, sons, and daughters. They also took much spoil from them, and they brought the spoil to Samaria. But a prophet of he who is was there, whose name was Oded, So there's still the sons of the prophets up in northern Israel, even though northern Israel's got a lot of problems. And one of these authentic prophets comes to this returning war party, and he went out to meet the army that came to Samaria and said to them, "Behold, because he who is the God of your fathers was angry with Judah, he gave them into your hand." So God allowed you to do what you just did as judgment against southern Judah. But you have killed them in rage that has reached up to heaven. You basically crossed the line. You did more than what you were supposed to do. And we'll see this as a principle in much of the judgment passages in the prophetic passages that we'll see soon. Now you intend to subjugate the people of Judah and Jerusalem, male and female, as your slaves. Have you not sins of your own against he who is your God? Now hear me. Send back the captives from your relatives whom you have taken, for the fierce wrath of he who is upon you. And certain chiefs, also among the men of Ephraim, Azariah and Berechiah and Jehizek, and Amasa stood up against those who were coming from war and said to them, "You shall not bring those captives in here, for you propose to bring upon us guilt against he who is in addition to our present sins and guilt. For our guilt is already great, and there is fierce wrath against Israel." So a bunch of the leaders says, "No, don't you dare bring those POWs in here." So the armed men left the captives and the spoil before the princes and all the assembly. And the men who have been mentioned above by name rose. They took the captives with the spoil. They clothed all of them that were naked. They clothed them. They gave them sandals, provided them with food and drink, anointed them, and carrying all the feeble among them on donkeys, they brought them to their kinsmen at Jericho, the city of palm trees. Then they returned to Samaria. So they returned the captives to Judah.